And in particular, so I'm going to introduce another function of a quantum state. Well, this is now a function of just a single quantum state, which is called the entropy. And this quantity is really important in quantum information theory. And you know, I'll mention at least two different operational interpretations of this quantity. One has to do with quantifying entanglement, the entanglement of pure states. And I'll talk about that just very briefly. But the other that we'll talk about a little bit more is quantum data compression. So, you know, the idea here will be, suppose you have some quantum state and you would like to represent it as succinctly as possible. And if you know something about the ensemble that it was drawn from, maybe you can do that. So, you know, if you know something in particular about the entropy of the quantum state, this will tell you something about how much you can compress it down, which might be useful if you want to send it over some channel and it's expensive to send things through that channel. Okay, so let's start off with entropy. So we're going to be talking about, you know, the von Neumann entropy, which is this quantity that describes the entropy of a quantum mechanical system. But the first thing we should do is we should take a step back and we should talk about the entropy of probability distributions, right? So we can also define a quantity called the entropy. So this was introduced by Shannon, so it's sometimes called the Shannon entropy. And it's some quantity which describes the amount of uncertainty in a probability distribution. So the Shannon entropy quantifies the amount of uncertainty in a probability distribution. And actually, this quantity has a lot to do with, you know, the concept of entropy that you come across in physics. You know, so for example, in thermodynamics, I think in fact the name entropy, you know, Shannon used this word entropy because the word entropy had already been used in physics, and there were a lot of similarities between the quantity that he was considering and you know, this quantity that was considered in physics. And I mean, you can really see these quantities as in some sense being the same thing. They have something to do with, you know, the number of possible states that a system could be in. Okay, so what is the Shannon entropy? So we should define it. So suppose we have some probability distribution P, where there's a probability PI for outcome I to occur. Then the entropy, which when we talk about the classical entropy, so the Shannon entropy, we usually use the symbol H. So H of a probability distribution P is, well, the sum over all the possible events of pi times the log of 1 over pi. So in other words, it's the average under the probability distribution p of the log of 1 over the probability. Or another way of writing this is that it's just minus the sum over I of pi log pi. Okay, this is the way that it's more commonly written, because you don't have to write 1 over something. But, you know, then you have to put this minus sign out front. And of course, you know, probabilities are numbers less than 1. So when you take the log of, you know, the log of a probability, you get a negative number. So of course, the entropy comes out being a positive quantity, even though it's usually written with this minus sign out front. Okay, so this is the entropy. And so one thing that I should mention is, you know, of course, we have to say something about what base we use for the logarithm. So the convention is to take log base 2. And we usually don't write the 2 because, you know, whenever we're talking about information theory, you know, it's typically most natural to use logarithms to the base 2. And when we do that, the unit of we could think about the unit of entropy being the bit. So the units are bits. So we could take the log to some other base, and of course it would change things just by some multiplicative factor. And so you could think about that as measuring entropy in different units. But, you know, typically it'll be most natural to think about things in terms of bits. Sometimes people, you know, consider the entropy where they use the natural log instead of the log. And so there's a unit for that. Sometimes people call that the nat. So the, you know, the amount of, so if you have, you know, the entropy being 1 where you use the natural log, then you would say there's 1 nat of entropy. And this is kind of a weird quantity. You'll see later on that it sort of makes more sense to take this thing to be an integer rather than some crazy number like E. Okay, so we'll represent our entropy here using bits. So maybe a simple example is an order. So this is, you know, very basic, but let's just do it. So what's the entropy in a fair coin? So suppose we have some coin that could be either you know, heads or tails with probability a half. Well, then the entropy would be, so we would have here, so we would have minus 1 half log a half. So that's corresponding to the outcome heads. And then we would have minus a half log a half. Right? So in other words, we have, well, just minus log a half, which is the same thing as the log of 2. Okay, and we remember that we represent our entropy you know, using logs base 2, so this is just 1. So in other words, we would say that there's one bit of entropy in a fair coin toss. So that says, you know, something about how uncertain it is when we toss a fair coin. There's basically one bit of information which is specified when we learn whether the coin came up heads or tails. So that's the sense in which it has one bit of entropy. And so correspondingly, for example, if we had a completely unfair coin, you know, one that would always come up heads every time we flip it, like in Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are Dead, you know, then there would be no bits of entropy, right? Because it's completely certain what's going to happen every time we flip the coin. And then you know, we could do the same calculation, and we would get the zero. So similarly, so the entropy in a completely biased coin is zero. Okay. Yes.
Shall entropy always be equal to the naive number of bits that you learn?
Well, what's the naive number of bits that you learn? I mean,
I don't mean naive in a bad sense. I just mean like we have a notion of how many bits we learn.
Right.
So does this abstract expression always coincide with that?
I mean, I would say yes. Yeah, but so, you know, what does that mean? I mean, I would say that actually this, in some sense, this quantity is almost defining the number of bits that we learn. I mean, so, how do you, there's sort of a question, which is like, how do you actually make that rigorous? And I think really the right way to think about it is in terms of how much can you compress the source, right? So if the number of bits that you learn per, you know, sample is less than 1, that should mean that you could compress the message down to fewer bits. So really, you know, when you think about how compressible the message is, that's a way of really quantifying and making rigorous this notion that you have of, you know, how many bits could you learn. So we'll see that this quantity relates to compression, and that will kind of help to make that precise. Okay. Good. So so we would like to see, I guess this is actually just the next thing I was going to say. I mean, we would like to see that this quantity has some operational meaning. I mean, here the fact that there was, you know, one bit of entropy corresponded to the fact that it would take really one bit to specify you know, how the coin came up every time. And we can sort of, you know, put this on some firm operational footing if we think about how compressible a source is. And so we'll see in a little bit that this has that this has this interpretation in terms of compression. Okay, so this relates to compression, and we'll see a bit more about this in a little bit. All right, now this is so far a completely classical notion. We have this, you know, for any probability distribution, we can calculate its entropy. And there's a corresponding quantum quantity, which is, you know, so it was defined by von Neumann. It's sometimes called the von Neumann entropy. And it's really just the natural quantum analog of this thing, where we think now about in general density matrices instead of probability distributions. So the von Neumann entropy of a density matrix row is, so the convention is to use the symbol S for this. So S of row is minus the trace of row log row. Okay, so again, this log you should interpret as being base 2. Now I'm taking the logarithm of a matrix, so what does that mean? Well, what I mean is, you know, this thing is a matrix, so I can is a Hermitian matrix, so I can diagonalize it in some basis. And what I should do is I should think about taking the logarithm of the eigenvalues, right? So I could think about taking that matrix, diagonalizing it, taking the log of the eigenvalues, and then undiagonalizing it, you know, if I'm thinking about some particular basis, in order to get the matrix log row. I take, you know, row times log row, and then I take the trace of that matrix, then I take minus that in order to get a positive quantity. Or another way of thinking about it is just think about taking the the eigenvalues of rho, the eigenvalues of a density matrix always form a probability distribution, right? Because a density matrix is a positive semi-definite operator with trace 1, right? So it has to have non-negative eigenvalues, and the eigenvalues have to sum up to 1. And so what you should do is you should just take the eigenvalues of the density matrix and take their Shannon entropy, right? So this is equal to the Shannon entropy of the eigenvalues. Okay. So I wanted to then mention a bunch of properties of, oh, yes.
So is it true that the entropy is the variant under the transition? If you choose the different
variant? Yes, yes, because it's only a function of the eigenvalues of rho. So if I were to write rho in some other basis, that would be, yeah, that would be a density matrix that would have exactly the same entropy. Yeah, that's right. Okay, so I wanted to mention some, you know, basic properties of the entropy. I'm not going to prove any of these. There's going to be kind of a long list of them. But it's good to know that, you know, entropy has many properties, that many nice properties that you can use in calculations. So I want to at least, you know, show you some of them quickly. Okay, so let's suppose that the density matrix rho lives in a d-dimensional space. Okay, so suppose rho is d-dimensional. So by that I mean it's a d by d matrix. Okay, well, so first of all, the entropy is certainly positive, just because the, you know, it's the entropy of the eigenvalues, and the Shannon entropy is always positive. And what's the largest value that the entropy can take? Can you see?
One.
Depends on the dimension of the density matrix in general. If it were a qubit, you would be right. It's log d, right? So it can be as big as log d. So log d is the amount of entropy. You know, if I consider a fair d-sided coin, log d is the number of bits of entropy in that. So in general, log d will be the largest possible value of the entropy. One is always a good guess. You know, if someone asks you a question in lecture, like there's a good chance that the answer is 1 or possibly 0, because it should be something nice. But that's only true if d equals 2 in this case. Okay. So first of all, what can we say about the possible cases where we could have zero entropy, or, you know, minimal or maximal entropy? Well, so S of rho is 0 if and only if rho is pure. So, you know, the pure quantum states are kind of the quantum analogs of the completely predictable probability distributions, right? So of course, if you were to make some measurements on a quantum state, you know, it's not that the outcomes would always be predictable, but we're just talking about the entropy of the eigenvalues of the quantum state. And so a rank 1 quantum state, in other words, a pure quantum state, is exactly the kind of state that's going to have, S of rho being 0. And when is S of rho going to be log d? So when is the state going to have maximal uncertainty in it? Well, that happens if exactly when the state is maximally mixed. So remember, the maximally mixed state of a d-dimensional system is just the one that's described by the density matrix being the identity. So this is when rho is 1 over d times the identity. So that's kind of a completely unpredictable quantum state in the sense of the von Neumann entropy. Okay, good. So let's see. So another thing that we can see is that if we think about mixing together a bunch of different density matrices, this will in general increase the entropy. So if I take S of the sum over I of pi rho I, so where this is a probability distribution and these are a bunch of quantum states, then in general I can have, I can only get more entropy than if I were to just take, than if I were to take the average of the entropies of the individual states. Right? So this is what's called concavity of the entropy. So for example, you know, an extreme case of this would be, well, there's a way of writing the maximally mixed state as a uniform mixture over all of the, you know, say some set of basis states. I fix some basis. If I take a uniform mixture over all of them, then I get the maximally mixed state. Well, that's something that has entropy log d, but the pure states have entropy 0, right? So certainly then this quantity is a lot bigger than this quantity. And in general, if I mix together a bunch of quantum states, I get a state with higher entropy. On the other hand, there's sort of an inequality that goes the other way, which says that the amount of additional entropy that you can have if you mix over a bunch of quantum states, if you want an inequality going the other way, the kind of additional amount that you have to add on the right-hand side is exactly the Shannon entropy of this probability distribution. So in other words, the entropy of the sum over I pi rho I is at most, the entropy of P, just the P is just a probability distribution, so this is just the classical entropy, plus the average of the entropies of the individual states. And actually, when do you get equality here? So you get equality here exactly when these states have orthogonal support, so that the amount of additional entropy you're adding to the system is exactly the entropy in the probability distribution that describes the mixing. Okay, good. Then there are a few relationships involving the entropy of multipartite systems that I want to mention just briefly, because there are things like this that are important. So first of all, if you have some system, some bipartite system that has two parts A and B, and if this state is actually a pure state, so if you have a pure state of a bipartite system, then one thing that you can see is actually the entropy of the two reduced states. So the entropy of the entropies of the two subsystems will actually be the same. So this is something you can see from something that's called the Schmidt decomposition, if you've seen that before. Another thing which is good to know is that if you have a system which is in a tensor product state, even if it's a mixed state, then actually the entropy is additive. So this is just the same thing as the entropy of A plus the entropy of B. Maybe I should not use like labels here. Well, I guess it's okay. It's clear what I mean. These are actually the reduced states, so I guess it's clear. Okay. Now, in general, if you have the density matrix of some bipartite system that's not necessarily in a tensor product state, there's an inequality that involves the reduced density matrices. So the entropy in some joint density matrix rho AB is at most the entropy of rho A plus the entropy of rho B. But sometimes it can be less. So this is called subadditivity of the entropy. Subadditivity with respect to tensor products. So another thing is that there's an inequality going the other direction. So this is sometimes called the Araki-Lieb inequality. So the entropy has to be at least, the difference of the two entropies. So S of rho A minus S of rho B. This is called the Araki-Lieb inequality. And so there's just one other inequality that I want to mention. We're definitely not going to prove it because it's actually incredibly hard to prove. But it's also... very, very useful in proving a lot of statements about entropies and things you might want to analyze in quantum information. So this is what's called the strong subadditivity of the entropy. And this is actually a statement about tripartite systems. So it says the following. So suppose you have some tripartite system. So it has some entropy S of rho A, B, C. Well, if I add that to the entropy of the B system, so that can be at most the entropy of the AB system, where I just trace out C, plus the entropy of the BC system. So this is quite a difficult inequality to prove, and it was sort of a breakthrough when it was proved. So this happened in the 1970s, actually. before people were thinking seriously about some of these kind of operational questions about quantum information. So it turns out that you can use this to establish a lot of, you know, a lot of nice things having to do with quantum information. Okay, so I just wrote down a lot of these properties of the entropy very quickly. At least some of the ones near the beginning maybe make a lot of intuitive sense. To kind of get a handle on some of these other properties, you would probably have to think about things a bit more. And I don't want to dwell on these things too much, but I just want you to kind of be aware that there are lots of useful inequalities that are satisfied by the entropy. And so when you're doing calculations in quantum information, it's good to know that these things are around. So I guess I would encourage you to read, for example, the section on entropy in the Nielsen and Chuang textbook or other other references if you want to get kind of a deeper understanding of what's going on with some of these inequalities. So are there questions at this point? Okay. So now what we would really like to see is that there are some operational statements that we can make about the entropy. So the main one that I want to talk about is compression. But actually, before we do that, just to make sure that we have time to get to it, I want to say something about the relationship of entropy to the entanglement of a pure quantum state. So entropy can be used to quantify, a pure state entanglement. Right, so notice that we saw that the entropy was, we could think of it in some way, the entropy of a density matrix as characterizing somehow the amount of mixedness in a quantum state, right? A state is pure only if the if and only if the entropy is minimal, and a state is maximally mixed if and only if the entropy is maximal. So in some sense, it's describing how mixed a quantum state is. And so if we think about the reduced state of a bipartite system that we want to know whether it's entangled or not, we can think about the entropy of the reduced state as giving us some kind of measure of how entangled it is. And we want to think about this, let's say, just in the context where the global state is pure. But then, of course, when we trace out one of the subsystems, the reduced density matrix may be mixed. And how mixed that density matrix is in the sense of the entropy gives us some kind of way of quantifying the entanglement, right? So if we actually had a pure quantum state that was in a tensor product, right, then we know, that the reduced density matrix of each of the individual systems will just be pure because the global state is pure, and if we just have a tensor product, we just have a tensor product of two pure states. So then, since the reduced states will be pure, we'll have zero entropy for because of this statement, it doesn't matter whether we talk about the entropy of the reduced density matrix of the A system or of the B system. Both of those will be pure states if the state is in a tensor product, and so the entropy will actually be zero. But on the other hand, if we consider, for example, a Bell state, then if you trace out one of the two parts, then you'll have actually a maximally mixed state as the reduced density matrix. So then you'll have a high entropy for one of the two reduced density matrices, and that kind of indicates that the state has a lot of entanglement. Okay, but there's a much more precise and much more operational sense in which the entropy quantifies the amount of entanglement in a pure state, and so that's the following. So what we can do is we could define some quantity which we would like to say quantifies the amount of entanglement of a density matrix, and it's just what of a pure state, and it's just what I said before. So the entropy of some bipartite state AB, the entanglement. So this is some measure of the entanglement. Is just going to be defined as the entropy of the trace over B of psi, and by this property that I wrote here, this is just the same as the entropy of the trace over A of psi. So something that you could think about would be, suppose you have a copy of psi, but what you would really like is some kind of standard state of entanglement, like a Bell state. So we could try to convert the state psi that we're given into a Bell state. So if we're just doing this one state at a time, then things get a little bit tricky. I mean, you can talk about this as well, but it makes the story a little bit trickier. But what makes things a bit nicer is to think about taking many copies of the state, many copies of psi, and trying to convert it to many copies of some standard entangled state, like a Bell state. So what you can show is the following. So if we have many copies of psi, then there's a procedure where all that we do is some local operations. So I mean, of course, if you can do global operations on the whole state, you can turn it into any pure state that you like. But the idea here is that it's a bipartite state. And so we're going to think about protocols where you can only act locally on system A or locally on system B or exchange classical messages between the two systems, but you can't do any global quantum operations. So this is a model which is sometimes called LOCC, or local operations and classical communication. OK, so there's a protocol which uses only local operations and classical communication, which will send n copies of a state psi to so n times this quantity, so n times the entanglement in psi, as quantified by the von Neumann entropy of the reduced state, of some standard state of, you know, say the state beta 0, 0, which was a Bell state. So we can get, you know, n times the entanglement in psi copies approximately, right? So we can get this state with fidelity approaching 1 as n goes to infinity. So we can do this by some LOCC protocol. So this is local operations and classical communication. Which is exactly what it sounds like. Okay, and furthermore, this transformation is asymptotically reversible. So if you have n times the entanglement in psi, as quantified by this, copies of a standard state, you can take that state and you can turn it back into psi. So if we have beta 0, 0 tensor n e of psi, we can implement some LOCC protocol. So Alice and Bob can implement some LOCC protocol where they do local operations on their states and they exchange classical messages, but they don't exchange anything quantum. And they can turn this into the state psi tensor n. Well, you know, with fidelity that approaches 1 as n goes to infinity. Yes?
In what context does the forward rate equal the backward rate, and in what context
does it? So, you know, the rate is which you can do this is this amount, the entanglement. And you know, that's the rate asymptotically. So n should be large. So there's some idea here that n is going to infinity. And so we're allowing there to be some error, right? So you could say, we're sending this state to something which is close to this for any n. But so what we would like is that the, you know, how close it is, so say the fidelity between the input state and the output state should go to 1 as n goes to infinity. Oh, okay, so this is a good question, right? So the story becomes much more complicated with mixed state entanglement. So, you know, if we had here mixed quantum states, there are states where you can, what you can do is you can try to convert the state into as many Bell pairs as you like, and then you can try to convert Bell pairs into as many copies of the state that you have as you like, and those two rates are not necessarily the same if you have mixed states. And this relates to the fact that there's what people sometimes call bound entanglement. So there's entanglement that maybe it takes to make the state, but you can't get it back out of the state. So the situation becomes indeed much more complicated with mixed quantum states. But as long as we focus our attention on bipartite pure states, there's a very nice kind of story here, which is that we can think about a standard currency of entanglement, which is the Bell state, and we can reversibly interconvert any pure state that we like into Bell states at a rate that's exactly given by the entropy of the reduced density matrix. So this really says that there's a sense in which you should think about there being only really one notion of how entangled a pure state is. Namely, you should think about this quantity, the entropy of the reduced density matrix. That's like a unique measure of how entangled the state is. And this is very useful, because if you want to think about protocols that use up entanglement, like teleportation or superdense coding, you don't have to worry about what kind of entanglement you're given, whether you're given some complicated entangled state psi, or whether you're just given these simple Bell states. You can really just always convert things reversibly into Bell states. and only worry about those, at least as long as you're in this asymptotic regime where you have many copies of the state. Yes? What is this thing we're doing? Okay, so these two kinds of protocols have two names, actually, and maybe I should tell you these, and they might help a little bit. So this is called entanglement distillation. There are different names for these things that are used sometimes when we're talking about pure states and mixed states, and I want to make sure I use the right names. Concentration and dilution, right. So this is called entanglement concentration. And this is called entanglement dilution. So the idea here is that you have some states which maybe don't have maximal entanglement in them. And what you would like to do is you would like to convert them into these standard states that kind of have this very concentrated entanglement. So you're concentrating the state into Bell pairs. And here what you're doing is you've got the Bell pairs. So there's some states that have entanglement in them. And what you would like is to use those to prepare some states that somehow have less entanglement in them. So you're somehow like diluting the entanglement in order to make these less entangled states. And in general, you'll be able to make more of them. You know, if psi is the state of a qubit, what will happen is that here you've got n qubits, but you'll be able to create some smaller number of Bell pairs than n, because it takes, you have to somehow combine together these states, put together the entanglement from many of these states just to make one Bell pair, because the states are less entangled that you're putting in. And on the other hand, here we have some very entangled states. And so if psi is some not very entangled state, we might be able to make many copies of psi from one copy of this very entangled state. So this is what you're doing, is you're kind of diluting the entanglement to make many copies of the state. Does this help? A little bit.
So can I think of there being some sort of a conservation of entanglement law?
That's true here. So here what we're doing is we're just performing local, actually, unitary operations and sending information back and forth. And so there is, in the sense of this measure, there's the same amount of entanglement in this state as there is in this state. Of course, there are operations that are allowed by the formalism that we've considered that will destroy entanglement, right? So we could just think about measuring away the state and being left with some probability distribution, and then we have no entanglement. So, if we consider those operations, then the entanglement is destroyed. On the other hand, if you think about the evolution of the whole system being unitary, then the entanglement is actually not lost if you're doing these local unitary operations. But now let me, go the other way again. So if you can sort of move systems apart from each other and, take systems and move them apart, then you can create entanglement, right? Because I can make some state which is, entangled with respect to some, let me put it this way. I mean, when you talk about whether a state is entangled or not, you have to have some partition of the systems. And so, entanglement is only really interesting when we have from the point of view of concepts like non-locality, when we have systems that are far apart from each other. So if you can make some system that's in some state, and then you take the two particles far apart, then you may make some state that has really interesting long-range entanglement in it, whereas it didn't before. So you have to think about the context, I think, in which you're talking about entanglement to kind of really make sense of that question. Okay, so this was just kind of like a quick rundown of this idea that we could think about using the entropy of the reduced density matrix as a way of quantifying entanglement. So this gives some operational meaning to the von Neumann entropy. Namely, if we're computing the von Neumann entropy of the reduced state of half of some pure entangled state, that gives us some measure of how entangled the state is. Yes. So we're talking about the entropy here of the reduced density matrix. So if we take a product state, that entropy will be zero, because the reduced states will still be pure quantum states. But if we have an entangled state, then the entropy will be big. It'll be non-zero.
I'm looking at the sub additivity property.
Here? Yeah.
Yeah. And so with the one above, it seems to suggest that a general entangled state.
Yes.
Less entropy than.
So now you're talking about the entropy of the global state. Yeah. That's true. Yeah, so here, if we have something which is in a product state, then the entropy will be just the sum of the individual entropies. The entropy can go down and can be less than the sum of the individual entropies if you're just considering the global state. This is just true. But I mean, now we're thinking about things a different way, right? We're taking the entropy of the whole density matrix rather than the entropy of just a reduced state. So you know, you certainly have to be careful about what context you're looking at the entropy in when you think about what it is that it means. Okay, so then what I wanted to spend the rest of the time on was talking about this concept of data compression, because this gives a second operational interpretation to what entropy is, and it's quite relevant if you want to think about, for example, how you would send quantum information as efficiently as possible through some quantum channel. So I think we probably won't have time to talk any more about entanglement, concentration, and dilution, but there'll be a problem on one of the tutorials where you can think a little bit more about this entanglement concentration problem. And actually, if you want to come up with a protocol for entanglement dilution, one way of doing it is to combine teleportation and this data compression that we're going to talk about in just a minute. So after you've seen how this data compression works, you could think about actually how to do this. So how would you construct a protocol for entanglement dilution? That's a nice exercise. Okay, so let's talk about compression now. So the compression problem is the following. So we have data which is produced by some source, and we would like to communicate it as efficiently as possible, right? So how can we represent data as succinctly as possible? And you can think about this in the context of classical data, and you can also think about it in the context of quantum data, where you have some information stored in quantum states. Okay, but now we want to have some way of giving this some precise meaning. I mean, the vague idea is that if there are some redundancies in the data, then you should be able to compress it and not have to represent that. But in order to have this, in order to make this a bit more precise, what we should think about is that the data is being output by some source. Okay, so to keep things really simple, we're going to imagine that the source is actually IID. So the symbols of the string that are output by the source are produced according to some probability distribution that's identical for every symbol that's produced, and the distribution of different characters are independent from each other. So we're going to consider an IID source. And then what we would like to see is that, in general, if we have some IID source, we can compress data that comes out of that source. And the rate of the compression that we can do turns out to be exactly the Shannon entropy. So this is the sense in which the entropy has some operational meaning that has something to do with compression. Yes?
So earlier, we're going to be talking about this in terms of talking in classical terms.
At first, then we'll make it quantum. But you'll see that actually, once we understand what's going on classically, it's not so hard to make it quantum. But my assumption is that probably not all of you have seen how this data compression works before. So I'm going to go through it in the classical context first. Okay. So first, let's do a really simple example to see how it is that you could actually imagine compressing a message. What would be involved in doing this? So suppose we have a source that outputs the following, has the following kind of output. So there are four possible symbols that it could output, A, B, C, and D. But they're not all equiprobable. We could have, some of those symbols occurring, some of those symbols will occur with higher probability than others. So suppose in particular we have the probability distribution where the symbol A occurs with probability a half, the symbol B occurs with probability a quarter, and the symbols C and D each occur with probability an eighth. Right. So, you know, the naive way to encode symbols from this source is, well, there are four possible symbols, so let's just use 2 bits to encode each symbol, right? So say, you know, 0, 0 for A, 0, 1 for B, 1, 0 for C, and 1, 1 for D. So, you know, the naive encoding would use 2 bits. You know, 2 bits per symbol. So we would say the rate of the encoding is 2. So 2 bits per symbol. Okay, but at least intuitively, that seems like maybe not such a great thing to do, because, you know, the different symbols are, you know, are more likely than others. So for example, you know, we're going to be seeing A's half the time on average if we have a long string. We'll always be considering, you know, this rate again in a kind of asymptotic setting, similarly to what we discussed briefly for entanglement, concentration, and dilution. So we're interested in doing the compression for some long message and having things be good on average. So, you know, if we're seeing A's half the time, maybe we should try to write them using, you know, in some more succinct way than, say, C's and D's, where we have, you know, a much lower chance of seeing them, right? So we could afford to use a longer string to represent C or D if that would allow us to use a shorter string to represent A. And if we did that, then we would have some savings in expectation. So maybe somebody can suggest how maybe we could encode these strings. We would like to somehow use shorter strings to encode the more likely events and longer strings to encode the less likely events. But of course, we have to do this in such a way that we can actually tell where the message breaks, right? I mean, you know, something which is nice about using 2 bits per symbol is that every time you see two bits, you know that that's the encoding of one character, right? But if we use strings of different length to represent different symbols, we have to be careful that we actually know where the message breaks and how we can break it up into pieces so that we won't get confused. Right, so yes? OK, good. So that's a good start.
And then 1 will indicate that you're in one of the other three.
Right.
And then you're going to have, well, because you want B to carry more often, that B is 1, 1. And then C and D will be 1, 0, 0, and 1, 0, 1.
OK. Sorry. And then C is?
1, 0, 0.
And D is? See, you have to be a little bit careful, right? Because. But what if you have, for example, you know, a D and then a C? So then you have, maybe you can tell them apart. Because then you have 101, 100. I guess in that case, you can tell them apart. So it's not completely obvious to me that this works. It might be that it works. But let me use a different encoding that I know works, and then we can think about whether this works. It's not completely obvious to me. So say we instead do this. So say we represent A by 0, and then B by 1, 0. So the idea is going to be that every time we see a 0, we know we're done seeing the message. That's the way I want to think about it. Somehow here there's some rule which is a little bit different for the different strings. It might work, but I'm just not sure. So let's say C is 1, 1, 0, and D is 1, 1, 1. So now, you know, here we don't have the 0 to indicate that we're done, but on the other hand, this is the only one that has 3 1s. So if we see 3 1s in a row, then also we know we're done, right? So every time we see a 0, we break, unless we've seen 3 1s in a row, and then we also break, right? So here, if we see some long string, then we know always where to break. We break every time we see a 0 or after we've seen 3 1s. And we can uniquely recover, you know, whether we had A, B, C, or D. Okay, so this would be some way of doing the encoding. I mean, it's perfectly valid because we can uniquely decode the message. But now the question is, how efficient is this? How many bits are we using per symbol? So now we should talk about, you know, how many bits per symbol are we using on average? Because we're using different numbers of bits for the different symbols, but they have different probabilities. So, well, let's just do a quick calculation. So this is the expected number of bits per symbol. Okay, so with probability half, we use 1 bit. With probability a quarter, we use 2 bits. And with probability with probability a quarter, we use 3 bits, right? So plus an eighth times 3 plus an eighth times 3. That's sort of. Yes. Yeah, in expectation over, you know, the random choice of these symbols. Okay, so you can do this calculation and you get 7/4. So 7/4 is less than 2, which is 8/4. Right? So we've actually got some savings. So that's great. I mean, we managed to encode the source using fewer bits per symbol. But now we might like to ask other questions, like, is this the best we could do? You know, could we do better than this? Could we somehow get by with fewer bits per symbol? Well, it kind of seems like maybe we did the best we could do using this kind of encoding where we looked at the symbols one at a time. But suppose we took the symbols more than one at a time. Maybe we tried to come up with some more sophisticated encoding where we look at maybe 10 symbols from the source before we decide how to encode those 10 symbols. Remember, we're only trying to do things asymptotically. Maybe we could do better. Well, it turns out that in this case, we cannot do better. And this is actually the best you can do. And the reason for that is that this is exactly the entropy of this probability distribution. So the entropy of the probability distribution, you know, where we have, you know, a half, a quarter, an eighth, is exactly 7/4. You can do that calculation, and you see it's exactly this, because actually this number, the number of bits that we use to encode each of these symbols, is exactly, the log of 1 over the probability, right? So the log of 1 over a half is 1, the log of 1 over a quarter is 2, et cetera. So we're really encoding each symbol in an optimal way because we're using exactly the log of 1 over its probability. So this is the entropy of the source, and we'll see later on, we'll see in just a bit, that actually, you know, the best you can hope to compress the source is down to its entropy. This is the optimal rate of compression. So actually, this is actually an optimal protocol. But in general, what we could be doing is indeed looking at looking at more characters from the source at a time. So here we didn't actually have to do this, but in general, we may have to use what are called block encodings. So we'll encode many characters from the source at a time. And what we'll worry about is only the asymptotic rate, so the rate at which we can compress the source into some bit string when we use block encodings. And so you know, this makes things nicer if we think about these block encodings, because for example, you know, in this nice case, the probabilities were all like 1/2. But you know, if that's not the case, then when we take the log of 1/2 probability, it may not even be an integer. So we couldn't even hope to encode into some integer number of bits. But if we consider these block encodings and we do things asymptotically, these sorts of issues about, you know, things being integers will wash away. So this is going to make things nicer. Okay. All right. So now what we would like to see is, you know, how we can think about encoding data more generally. So, you know, suppose we have some general source where it's not just these nice probabilities that we had in this example, but where we just have some general source. So to keep things simple, let's just think about the case where there are only two symbols, 0 or 1. That's like the simplest interesting case, but where the probabilities of those two symbols are arbitrary. So more generally, consider a source of bits where we have 0 with probability p and 1 with probability 1 minus p. And you know, all the considerations that we think about in this case where we're encoding bits will carry over in a pretty straightforward way to the case where you have some larger alphabet, like here where we had 4 symbols in the alphabet. Okay, so we have 0 with probability p, 1 with probability 1 minus p, and we want to think about how to compress a string that's generated by this source. Okay. So first of all, we should think about, you know, what do we sort of expect the messages that come out of this source to look like? So a string from this source has, let's say, alpha times n ones, where alpha is some number between, so I want an n-bit string. An n-bit string from this source has alpha times n ones with probability, well, the probability, or let me say alpha times n zeros. Sorry. So the probability of a zero is p. So we have p to the power of alpha n. And then we have 1 minus p to the power of 1 minus alpha n. Okay, so that's the probability that we have exactly alpha times n zeros, because this is the probability. I guess that a particular n bit string with alpha times n zeros has this probability, right? Because of course there's also some factor that says that we have, you know, n choose alpha n strings, you know, because we have the choices of where the zeros go. So let me rewrite this. So a particular n bit string with alpha times n zeros has this probability. Good. All right. So now, you know, what can we say about the probability that we have? How many zeros are we going to expect, right? So what's the expected number of zeros in a string, in an n bit string that comes from this source? So like, what's the typical number of zeros we would expect to see? What's the typical value of alpha? P, right? Because the probability that we see a zero for any one string, for any one character, is p. So if we see, you know, n characters, then we would expect to see p times n zeros. So we expect to see approximately p times n zeros. Okay. So what's the probability of a string with p times n zeros? So the probability of such a string, in particular such string, is p times n times 1 minus p to the 1 minus p times n. Okay. So let's take the log of that probability, because that's kind of the sort of expression that we're going to see when we take the entropy, right? So the log of p to the pn times 1 minus p to the 1 minus p n is just pn log p plus 1 minus p n log 1 minus p, so just using the rules for logarithms. And if I factor out the n, this is just n times, so a quantity that we might write as h2 of p, and there's a factor of minus of an overall minus sign, okay, where this is just the entropy of a probability distribution that has two outcomes that occur with probabilities p and 1 minus p. So this is called the binary entropy. Right? So where h2 of p is minus p log p minus 1 minus p log 1 minus p. Okay, which is exactly the Shannon entropy in a biased coin, where the probability that heads comes up is p. So this is the binary entropy. Okay, so this was the log of this quantity that we cared about. So in other words, what we think, you know, should be the probability of the strings that we kind of typically expect to come up. So right, so the typical strings that arise have about p times n ones, and the probability of any such string is 2 to the minus this quantity, right? Because we took the log, or rather it's 2 to this quantity, right? So the probability of each typical string is, it's about 2 to the minus n times the binary entropy of p. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to say that a string is typical. We could make this more precise, but we're going to say that a string is typical if it has about the expected number of zeros. Right? So say a string is typical if it has about n times p zeros. And now what can we say about how many typical strings there are? Right, I mean, the probability that we get some string has to be 1, right? So because of that, you know, if each of the individual probabilities is about 2 to the, 1 over 2 to the n h2 of p, there can be at most 2 to the n h2 of p typical strings, right? Because if there were more than that, then there would be probability more than 1. So there can be at most 2, well, so, you know, I'm being very hand-wavy here, but so there can be at most about 2 to the n times h2 of p typical strings. So then what does that say about how we can compress the source? Well, suppose we only care about transmitting the typical strings. And, you know, if we happen to get an atypical string, that's something which is unlikely. So we sort of allow ourselves to just say, well, it won't work in that case, but it'll only work for the typical strings. Well, if that's the case, we can just make a list. I mean, we're not going to worry about computational efficiency here. So we could just imagine that we make a list of all the typical strings, and we just write down the index in that list. And there are only this many of them. So the number of bits that it takes to write down which typical string we got is just n times the binary entropy of p. Right? So we can specify which typical string occurred with about n times the entropy of p bits. Okay, and this is just what happens in this case where we have a source where the symbols are bits. More generally, we could have, you know, some larger alphabet, and then this h2 of p would just be the entropy of the source. So this h2 of p is just the entropy of this binary source. But if we had a more general source, you know, we could go through similar considerations, and we could see that the typical strings would be just the ones that, we could specify which typical string we got with about n times the entropy of the source bits. Okay. So this says that if we only care about encoding the typical strings, which are the ones that are most likely to occur, then we only need we can do that at a rate which is the entropy of the source. This may not be totally appealing because what if we don't get a typical string? I mean, that might be rare, but we might want something that would always work. But what we could say would be, well, maybe if we get some atypical string, let's just write out the whole string. You know, we'll just be wasteful in that case. And we'll just write out the string in the clear. You know, maybe we have some symbol at the beginning that says, okay, we're in the atypical case, and then we just write out the whole string. And so, you know, sometimes we may have to use more bits, but we're only caring about what happens in expectation. So since that's very unlikely, it won't really change the expectation. So you know, we can encode atypical strings basically any way we like. Let's just say uncompressed, and still use about n times h2 of p bits in expectation. Okay, so now, you know, what you would really like to do is, you know, make all of this rigorous and have some notion of, you know, an epsilon typical string, where you have some parameter epsilon that says how far from the most typical case you consider. And so you can prove theorems that say, you know, there's a certain number of epsilon typical strings. You know, most of the strings are epsilon typical, and there aren't too many of them. And put epsilons in all of these statements to kind of get rid of these squiggly equal signs. You know, we're out of time, so we're not going to do that. But you could make statements like that and sort of make all of these kinds of things rigorous. And so if you do that, what you can get to is something that's called Shannon's noiseless coding theorem that really makes this more precise. So I want to write down what that is. So this theory was developed by a guy named Claude Shannon in the 1940s in some paper where he basically laid out the foundation for all of information theory, and this was one of the two main theorems in that paper. So what we're going to do is we're going to consider an IID source with distribution P. And we're going to call an encoding reliable if the probability that you make some error goes to 0 as n goes to infinity. So call an encoding reliable if the probability of an error goes to 0 as n goes to infinity. So this is you know, not worrying about this idea of how you would encode the atypical strings, but maybe just like making a mistake in some case. Yes. Yeah, that's right. So we're going to have some kind of a procedure that consists of a compression phase and a decompression phase, right? We have to be able to, you know, compress the string, and then we have to be able to recover it from the compression. So we could always define, you know, some compression scheme as some map on the inputs, but then it's only good if we can actually decompress the output. And so, you know, if we combine those two things and we actually can decompress the output all the time, then actually the probability of an error would be 0, and then that would be kind of an okay situation. So we're going to call an encoding reliable if the probability of an error goes to 0. And then we're going to say that the rate of an encoding is r if we encode n bits into r times n bits. So then what this theorem says is that, so first of all, if you're trying to encode at a rate which is less than the entropy, then you can do that. So if r is less than the entropy of the source, and this is now in general just the Shannon entropy of the source, then there exists a reliable encoding. And on the other hand, there's a converse of this statement that says that if you try to encode it at too high a rate, you know, if you try to get greedy and, you know, encode into fewer bits than the entropy, then there just won't exist a reliable encoding. In other words, any encoding will inevitably have to introduce some errors. So if the rate is above the entropy, then, you know, you can't asymptotically be reliable. So then no reliable encoding exists. Well, you know, we're only caring about asymptotics, so let's not worry about the case where the rate is exactly equal to the entropy. I mean, the theorem really does say this, so it doesn't say anything about the case where the rate is actually equal to the entropy. You know, so I think you just won't be able to make a statement about what happens, because you have to be either a little bit below or a little bit above for things to behave nicely as n goes to infinity. Yeah. I mean, of course, there are cases where, you know, you can actually achieve a rate which is equal to the entropy. So, for example, that happens with this source, right? So here we saw that, in fact, even without going to asymptopia, we could already get the, you know, we could already achieve the entropy just with a simple encoding. But I think you just can't say that about an arbitrary source. Could be wrong, but. I think that's the case. Probably Sarah knows better than me. Do you know? Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, okay. So that's my intuition too. Okay, so now we're over time and we've only gotten through the classical stuff. But it's actually not that hard to do the quantum stuff. But I think what we'll do maybe is maybe we should just break now, and I'll talk about it briefly at the start of the next lecture so we don't go over time by a ridiculous amount. But what we'll see next is that, you know, you can consider a very analogous kind of problem where instead of being given a string of bits from some IID source, you're given some sequence of quantum states. So you're going to be given some quantum states that are drawn from some IID quantum source where you have some density matrices that are produced with various probabilities. And then you would like to encode that quantum message as efficiently as possible. And what we'll see is that there's a very analogous kind of theorem, which is called Schumacher's, you know, noiseless quantum coding theorem, which basically says that the amount that you can compress the message is exactly down to a rate which is equal to the von Neumann entropy. So this will give us a second operational interpretation for the von Neumann entropy, and the fact that holds basically, I mean, there'll be almost no work to do because you know, we'll just have to sort of think about the quantum state in the right basis, and then it'll be kind of clear that exactly the same considerations allow you to compress down to the Shannon entropy. But we'll talk about that a little bit briefly next time, I think. And then the next thing that we're going to do is to go on to talk about quantum error correcting codes, which would allow you to deal with situations where you have noisy channels. Okay, good. Any other questions? Yes. Right. Well, you know, so this is just a, you know, this is a an encoding scheme that allows you to actually achieve the entropy. So that doesn't, you know, of course, that's not inconsistent with a theorem because the theorem didn't even say anything about the case where the rate was equal to the entropy. So I mean, it's perfectly fine. But that's just a particular, you know, concrete protocol, right? So it's not saying anything about the general theorem. The general theorem just says there always exists some encoding. And here, well, we see what you know one such encoding actually looks like. Okay, great. So see you tomorrow.